seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in First National Bank of Kerrville versus Odell.
May it please the court, Mr. Frank Alder will present argument to petitioners. Mr. Alder is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Frank Oliver. I'm here this morning on behalf of the petitioners, First National Bank of Kerrville, and Mr. Michael Childers in his capacity as substitute trustee under a deed of trust for the benefit of the bank. This case involves the proper application of principles of subrogation to a mortgage financing transaction. The property in question is located in Bandera County, and it is from the Bandera County District Court through the Court of Appeals that we have come here today. Counsel have agreed on the joint use of a chart which depicts the pertinent transactions affecting the property. Simply stated, the facts are these. In 1981, Mr. Davis owned 190 acres in Bandera County. He sold the property to Mr. Walters. Mr. Walters gave back to Mr. Davis a promissory note as a part of the consideration for the purchase price. The parties in this case have, for purposes of convenience, referred to the various promissory notes at issue by reference to the name of the payee of those notes, so that in this case, for example, the Davis note, as we refer to it, would mean the promissory note which Mr. Walters executed in favor of Mr. Davis when Mr. Walters purchased the property in 1981. A year later, Mr. Walters sold the property to respondent Odell. And in connection with that transaction, Odell executed a promissory note payable to Mr. Walters, which we refer to as the Walters note. He also assumed the liability for the Davis first lien note through an assumption deed. Thereafter, in July of 1984, Mr. Odell himself sold the property to the 237-acre Bandera Ranch Partnership. In connection with that transaction, the partnership executed a note back to Mr. Odell. That is referred to as the Odell third lien note. The partnership did not assume at that time any liability on the existing first and second Davis and Walters lien notes. 2 years later, in July of 1986, my client enters the picture and enters into a loan transaction with the partnership. In that transaction, the partnership executed a new promissory note for $570,000. That promissory note encompassed and included within its principal amount the monies which were owed on the first and second lien Davis and Walters notes. In essence, what happened in that transaction in July of 1986 was that $380,000 was actually advanced to the partnership in its capacity as borrower. The remaining balance of the $570,000, being approximately $189,000, was paid to Davis and Walters for the acquisition of their liens and indebtedness against the property. The transaction in July of 1986 between the bank and the partnership was designed and structured in every respect to preserve for the benefit of the bank the first and second lien priority of the Davis and Walters indebtedness. The monies paid to Davis and Walters were dispersed directly to them by the bank. The originals of the Davis and Walters notes were endorsed by Davis and Walters to the bank and delivered to the bank. Davis and Walters each executed written transfers of lien, transferring to the bank their deed of trust lien against the property.
Counsel, since that gets us almost through the chart, and you indicate that this is an agreed chart?
Essentially, it is.
There is not any dispute among the parties then over the facts in this case?
That would be my position, that the facts are undisputed. They are depicted by the written documents that were executed, and it is our position, Your Honor, that principles of equitable subrogation, as historically applied by this court and the other courts of this state, clearly conferred upon the First National Bank of Kerrville the lien position of Davis and Walters.
Each side here moved for summary judgment and represented to the court that there was no dispute as to the facts.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
And so there is little to be accomplished from remanding this. It's going to be up or down from one side or the other, isn't it?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
There does, in going through the briefs, perhaps it's a matter of emphasis or interpretation of those facts, seem to be a slightly different view of the facts between the two of you when you compare your brief to their brief.
Well, and that may be inevitable when we get to this stage. I think part of that is the argument that gets made over the Fleetwood case, which is a case from the Austin court. Writ was denied by this court, and it was sent back for retrial. And I think Fleetwood is a case in which there was a holding in which summary judgment was reversed. Summary judgment had been based upon equitable subrogation. I think a correct reading of the Court of Appeals decision there was that equitable subrogation, being ultimately an equitable doctrine, is one which is fact-sensitive, which is to be decided upon the totality of the circumstances in a particular case, and I think the facts were sufficiently murky in Fleetwood that a remand was proper. I would submit that in our case, we do not have that factual murkiness or lack of clarity.
Well, one example is the dispute over the meaning of paid off. Is that a factual dispute, or is that a matter of law?
I think it's a matter of law, and I don't think that there is a factual dispute there, Your Honor. I think what happened in the Court of Appeals, the trial court granted summary judgment for my client, the bank. The Court of Appeals reversed and rendered. Following our transaction in July of 1986, by the following summer, the loan was in default. The bank foreclosed in August of 1987. Its lien. In November of 87, just a few months later, Mr. O'Dell, Respondent
Which,
O'Dell.
When you say its lien, you mean the fourth, the first, or the second?
All of them. All of them. It foreclosed its $570,000 deed of trust. When the dust settled in July of 1986, when the bank's transaction was concluded, the bank had a first and second lien against the property to the extent of the $189,000 which it had advanced to acquire the Davis and Walters notes. Mr. O'Dell, Respondent O'Dell, had a third lien with respect to some $200,000, and the bank then had a fourth lien position with respect to the $380,000, which was advanced as cash to the borrower in the summer of 1980.
Was there other security for the bank? Was there other security for the bank to look to?
There may have been a guarantee, but I do not believe that there was other collateral to my knowledge. There's none reflected in the record that I'm aware of. The bank deed of trust recites specifically that the Davis and Walters notes were renewed and extended and carried forward in the bank's deed of trust. It further recites that those liens are valid and subsistent. The bank's deed of trust has an express, explicit subrogation clause, which recites that in the event any of the monies advanced under the $570,000 note and deed of trust are used to discharge or pay theretofore existing indebtedness on the property, that the bank is entitled to be subrogated to the position of the party receiving payment. The bank did everything that can be done in order to preserve that lien priority. It did everything that is customarily and typically done in these transactions to retain and preserve lien priority for the lender who steps in and provide necessary refinancing. The courts of the state have recognized really two variations of subrogation. One is so-called contractual or conventional subrogation. That is subrogation which arises by contract, by the written instruments between the parties. The second variant, and these are really close cousins if not brothers, is so-called legal subrogation, which really is something of a misnomer because it is equitable subrogation in its purest form. It is subrogation, legal subrogation is subrogation which arises purely by application of equitable principles to the facts at hand. It's our position in this case that both variations of that doctrine provide us with the lien priority that my client paid $189,000 to Davis and Walters to secure. First of all, under contractual or conventional subrogation, if we look at the instruments that were executed in the summer of 1986, they leave no doubt. The deed of trust has all the recitations that you would find. The promissory notes were endorsed and delivered to the bank. Davis and Walters executed written transfers of lien. There can really be no question that the bank was intended by the borrower, Davis, Walters, and itself, to step into the shoes of the first and second liens.
Assuming that you did, didn't those original lien holders have to give notice of foreclosure?
It is our position that they did not.
They did not. Walters and Davis did not.
They had to under the terms of their original notes. Those original promissory notes, in the case of the first lien note, Mr. Davis's note, it provided that the borrower would be given a 15-day notice of default and opportunity to cure. It also contained no waiver of the common law right of notice of intent to accelerate. The Walters note, the second lien note, did not contain a notice of default provision, but it did not waive the common law rights. When First National Bank of Kerrville structured its transaction in the summer of 1986 with the partnership, the then owner of the property, the promissory note that was executed for $570,000 dispensed with any requirement of notice of default and waived any obligation to provide notice of intent to accelerate.
I don't see how you can have it both ways. I don't see how you can say that the first and second lien notes remained in existence so that you were subrogated to some rights that they had, particularly their lien rights, but they didn't remain in existence for purposes of the notice request.
The law is, we believe, well settled in the state that the present owner of property, in this case the partnership, and the present holder of the indebtedness, in this case the bank, are free among themselves, without the joinder or consent of the original maker of the note, to modify the terms of the indebtedness however they choose to do so, without restriction. That is key to our argument. If the court disagrees with that, then I think Odell was required to receive notice.
But Mr. Odell is liable on one of these notes.
He was not liable at the time.
Liable on both of them.
He was discharged from liability because, and I think it's important to recognize the sequence of events here, when Odell sold the property to the partnership took the property subject to the Davis and Walters notes, and at that time, it is clear that Odell was still liable on those notes. And any foreclosure at that time would have required that he be given notice because he was still the primarily liable party. However, 2 years later, when the partnership, the then owner of the property, entered into the transaction with the bank, the partnership assumed liability for the first and second Davis and Walters lien notes. Included within that $570,000 is the money that was owed to Davis and Walters. The law is clear that when that occurs, the original maker, who no longer owns the property, is reduced to surety status only and is not the primarily liable party. However, because the bank and the partnership changed and modified the terms of the indebtedness, deleting, for example, the requirement of notice of default, changing the payment terms, that ipso facto released Odell from any continuing liability on the first and second lien notes.
I think that divested him of his interest, basically. It made him subject to the whim of the bank in this case. You're arguing for equitable subrogation, and yet in exercising the equity that you assert, bank's equity, you're totally divesting Mr. Odell of his equitable interest.
But he achieved a benefit through it. He was released from liability. And I think that that's a fair rule, ultimately. If the rule is going to be that the original maker of the promissory note must consent to any rearrangement of the terms of the debt, you, in effect, put a veto power in his hands. Do we want original makers, who may not even be around or subject to being located, to have veto power?
Well, why should he give up his right to notice just because other people agreed, made some agreements as to the debt?
Because he was no longer an owner of the property.
That's an aside, though. He might still have been, he might not have been. That's just a fortuity in this case.
Well, if he voluntarily sold the property, I think it's important that we keep in mind that Mr. Odell had every opportunity to protect himself here and did not. It is quite typical and common for junior lien holders, before stepping into the status of junior lien holder, to secure estoppel agreements from first and second lien holders or superior senior lien holders, requiring imposing an obligation on the senior lien holder to give notice. That is a very typical and common transaction, and one which a prudent junior lien holder will do.
He already had it in his note.
But he wore two hats in this transaction, Your Honor. The one hat he wore was he was the maker of the original note, and it was with that hat on that he had this agreement. That agreement was designed to protect him from a deficiency judgment following a foreclosure, that he could go to foreclosure and protect himself. It was not designed to protect any perceived equity in the property. With his third lien holder hat on, a separate and distinct status with respect to property, he clearly was not entitled to notice. The foreclosure statute does not require that notice be given. The cases have uniformly held that junior lien holders are not entitled to notice. And it's the legislature's judgment that the notice they get is the posting at the courthouse.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
And please support Mr. Jerry Steele will present argument for respondent.
Good morning. Please support Jerry Steele, San Antonio, representing David Odell, who responded in this matter.
May I ask you initially, before you get underway here, the same questions I did your opposing counsel, that you are also of the opinion that there's nothing to be accomplished by a remand, that it's an up or down matter on the law, no factual dispute of any kind between the two parties?
There is essentially no factual dispute in this transaction how it occurred. There may be fact issues to be resolved with respect to the bank's motion. Right now I cannot point specifically anyone out, but I would hesitate to say at this point that it should not be remanded ultimately if this case were reversed. The way the facts are presented, these are essentially undisputed. I think we may have taken what could be a fairly simple factual situation, maybe made it appear to be more complicated than it really is. As you can see, the timeline moves from left to right. There were two prior property owners before David Odell, and then the partnership acquired the property from David Odell at this point. Two points, if I don't make any other points with respect to the facts that I want to make and want to leave you with today, are: when David Odell sold the partnership to the ranch, it was strictly subject to the first two liens, and it was strictly subject to whatever rights that he held in those liens and in that debt. We have enumerated down here some of those salient points with respect to the first two liens, primarily the expressed contractual right under the first lien to give 15 days written notice before acceleration of the maturity of that debt in the event of default. And of course, there was no Ogden waiver with respect to either note as to notice of intent to accelerate or notice of acceleration. And it is those terms that David Odell remained liable under, and he enjoyed those benefits by remaining subject to the first two liens. I would like to point out one other thing.
If his indebtedness was discharged, then why should he get to keep the right to notice?
Well, for this reason. When this transaction, when Odell transferred the property to Bandera Ranch Partnership, this portion of the transaction was structured in such a way that he was relying upon, for his protection and his property interest, the third lien, he was relying upon his rights over the first two liens. Consequently, I disagree with counsel that someone can come in the form of a bank loan, pay off, or their words, pay off the first two liens in order to strip away whatever rights David Odell may have had to protect his property interest being the third lien. They cannot, and we would submit, they cannot unilaterally go in without notice of any kind to Odell, pay off the first two liens, take the transfer, and at the same time strip away his rights that he had contracted for and bargained for and had relied upon at the time he structured his transaction in the sale to the partnership.
They say that because those notes were renewed and extended, he discharged as a matter of law. Why isn't that correct?
I disagree with that.
Then usually a debtor wants to be discharged.
That's correct, unless he has some special interest, as in this case. And I think when we talk about equities, we have to look at the totality of the situation. The equity in this case for Odell is that if there had been any default in the first two liens, he had the absolute right, and it was demonstrated at the trial as well, that he had the financial wherewithal to perform and pay off these first two liens. In each case, he had the right to prepay at any time without penalty each note, and if he had been able to exercise those rights, which would have, and what would have triggered those rights would have been the notices that he had bargained for in the first two liens, if he'd been able to exercise that right, he could have protected his property interest in the third lien. He never was. He was deprived of that right, and the law should not stand for the fact that if someone bargains for rights such as notice and the right to prepay and protect your property interest, being in this case a third lien, that the law should not allow that to be stripped away without any knowledge to Odell in this case.
Did he have obligations under either of those first two liens to keep a current address? Was there some address in them?
Keep a current address?
Well, there are, your opponent, the petitioners, make arguments about restraint on alienation. The problem with this third lien hold, it disappears and can't be found. Is that a straw man or is that a real problem? In other words, how can everyone in Odell's situation, how can we assure that they get notice? Or is there some obligation in there on Odell's part to keep his whereabouts known so that he could be notified?
I think there's some obligation on Odell's part. That was not a factor in this case. Odell.
I'm thinking not this case, but the larger policy arguments.
I understand, and I think there is some obligation on the part of a person who enjoys a benefit or has property interest, and if he's relying upon certain notice rights, as in this case, he does have an obligation to make it known to the first two lien holders where he can be located.
And I wondered if that was expressly a contractual obligation or if you're just saying that would be, that's an implied.
I think that's implied. That was not expressed. Let me point out one other thing that was also expressed in the contractual language. When this transaction between Odell and the partnership was negotiated, it was also expressly stated that the partnership could make direct payments to the first two lien holders. It also, and that's in the deed of trust on the third lien, and it expressly stated that in the event the partnership made direct payments to the first two lien holders, that they would not be liable. It would not be an assumption of that indebtedness, that they would not be liable for the first two liens, and that Odell would remain liable. So I disagree with the petitioner in this respect, that where they contend that as a matter of law, by making the direct payments to the first two liens, that constituted an assumption as a matter of law. In this case, it was specifically contracted that if they did in fact make direct payments, it would not be an assumption of that indebtedness. So I believe those contractual rights should and would override any operation of law by those direct payments.
once again...
The petitioners argue that Odell was not entitled to notice because at most he was a co-debtor without an interest in the property. What's your response to that?
I disagree with that. I don't think Odell ever changed his position with respect to being the original obligor on the first two liens. Let me point out one thing, too, with respect to the equitable or the subrogation aspect of this. Traditionally, subrogation has been defined, and I just pulled Black's Law Dictionary to demonstrate this. A portion of the definition out of Black's says that subrogation is a legal fiction through which a person who, not as a volunteer or in his own wrong, and in the absence of outstanding and superior equities, pays the debt of another, is substituted to all rights and remedies of the other, and the debt is treated in equity as still existing for his benefit. The language that I want to point this court to in that definition, which is pretty typical of what definitions you would see out of the Texas courts, is that the debt is treated in equity as still existing for the benefit of the party paying that. And the reason I point that out is because something happened in this case that I think is very unique. That is, if you apply the doctrine that the debt and the lien is carried forward in a subrogation transaction, and in almost every case, and that the debt and lien cannot be separated, and this court, in its opinion, in Continental State Bank versus Pepper in 1937, held that a lien against property is incidental to and inseparable from the debt secured thereby. Now, what happens in subrogation is that the debt and the lien are both brought forward to the benefit of the party paying it. This was in the form of an equitable assignment. This was also pointed out in the case of McDermott versus Steck, a 1940 Court of Appeals, Austin Court of Appeals case, writ refused. And the significance of that is that the petitioner bank in this case, in their zealousness to demonstrate that Odell no longer had any rights in these first two liens, took the position both at trial level and in the Court of Appeals that by the payment by the bank of the loan to the partnership, that this totally took care of and satisfied appellant's obligation on the notes, appellant being Odell. They also took the position that once this payment was made, the appellant was released of liability. And they also took the position that the assignments here from the first two lien holders to the bank, that the only things that were extended and carried forward out of that transaction were the liens and not the debt. And it is that position that the San Antonio Court of Appeals adopted when they held that in keeping with the case of Tees versus Republic Bank, it's a Dallas Court of Appeals 1970 writ refused NRE case that states that an assignment of lien without the debt is ineffective and void. You cannot separate the debt and the lien. The bank took the position that the debt was not transferred, even though I would say contrary to the documentation that is here, but they stated and took a judicial position that the debt was not transferred. If that is a correct position, then based on the Tees case and the Continental State Bank case, they separated the debt from the lien. The lien at that point was extinguished, and this is why the court in San Antonio held that if these two liens were extinguished, third lien ripened into a first lien, and a foreclosure by Odell in November was a superior foreclosure to the one conducted by the bank a few months earlier.
You say if it was correct, but you acknowledge it's not correct, that if a person in the position of the bank pays off prior indebtedness that is secured, it steps into the shoes of that security, huh?
It does, unless they take a position where they repudiate the debt.
So they just gave it away, in other words. Which gave away $189,000.
That's correct.
That's
right. They took a judicial, a contrary judicial position wherein they repudiated the debt, which they could have enjoyed the benefit of that under subrogation normally, or you'd look to other issues in this case, but by their repudiation of the debt and taking the legal judicial position that only the lien was transferred and carried forward, that ran contrary to the Tees case, and the San Antonio Court of Appeals held accordingly.
Just in case it didn't do that, then was your, even if you're right about the right to notice having been preserved, O'Dell's foreclosure was still subject to the first two liens?
If there was, that would be correct.
So now, the next to last line in the CA's opinion extinguished the rights of the First National Bank, that would not be true except as to the inferior in the security position of the bank.
Well, that would not be true, but understanding that the San Antonio Court of Appeals adopted the Tees position, the Tees versus Republic Bank, and of course held that the O'Dell foreclosure was the first lien. And let me point out one other thing. The Platt versus Securities Investment holding, which is a Commission Appeals judgment adopted in 1932 case, held for two points, very important points. That in subrogation, what rights you do enjoy as a subrogee are subject to the limitations, burdens, and disqualifications of your predecessor creditors.
Can we put this in layman's terms? I'm trying to understand in a very simple way this whole transaction. If you buy a paper from someone, you buy what they call buying the paper in the trade, I guess. You take that paper, you take that lien, you take that note when you buy it, subject to all of its terms and conditions. You cannot eradicate any of the debtor's rights or protections. You take it according to all of its terms and conditions. You have no greater right than the previous creditor from whom you bought the paper. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's what the Platt decision stands for.
You have a right to collect the debt. You have a right to foreclose the lien. The bank here did more than buy the paper, apparently. They paid off the lien, and they had no intent of collecting on the debt. So they eradicated the whole transaction. They eradicated the lien and the debt. They paid off the debt of Mr. O'Dell. At the same time, they eliminated the first and second lien because it was paid off. In other words, they did not assume any, they didn't buy the paper. They didn't assume the right to collect the debts from O'Dell. Is that correct?
Yes, they did assume the right to collect the debt from O'Dell.
They're saying they just repudiated that debt, didn't they?
Well, they took that position judicially. Now, if you want to look at it from a subrogation standpoint, forget the T's.
Well, what I'm saying is, if they bought the paper, then they couldn't eradicate his rights of notice, the protections that were included
that is correct in the
transaction with the partnership.
That is correct. And if you want to, I think this has to be analyzed from two standpoints. One is a contractual subrogation approach. The other would be an equitable subrogation approach. Contractually speaking, all that occurred was the two liens and the notes were transferred to the bank. The original obligor was still O'Dell. And then when the bank attempted to modify the terms of these documents, they failed to have included the one party that was the original obligor and the primary obligor at that time in order to modify. Now, we cited numerous contracts cases which state that, of course, the contracting parties have to join in a modification. You can't unilaterally modify a contract. This is all this is from a contractual approach. And they failed to include O'Dell when they tried to modify and strip away the notice requirements under the first two liens in the notes.
Well, I think this is what Judge Heck was alluding to a while ago. They really can't have it both ways. If you buy in that paper, you take it subject to all its terms and conditions, including the conditions of the sale of the partnership, the protection that Mr. O'Dell had built in for himself in that sale. You take it subject to all those conditions, and you can't say we're going to eliminate all those rights because we paid these things off and thereby divest you of any right to notice and protection that you might have had in a foreclosure situation. But at the same time, we're going to assume the authority or take the power of those first two liens to conduct foreclosure that's has precedence over yours.
I would point out, too, that that works both contractually, what you're talking about, and also equitably with regard to the plat decision. If I could move on to one other point, very important point that I want to make before this court in my limited time. With respect to equitable subrogation, this court handed down a decision in 1969, which was Providence Savings versus Sims. In that case, it was a fairly typical situation where you had a first lien with an intervening lien holder and then a third lien or lender paying off the first lien, and the question was subrogation and the rights there too. The court, of course, held that the party was subrogated to the first lien rights in that transaction, but there was one thing that the court kept pointing out in that opinion in at least four occasions, and that was that there was no prejudice to the intervening lien holder. In fact, this court stated specifically that in that case that the position and rights of the intervening lien holder were not prejudiced thereby. So this court pointed out specifically the rights of the intervening lien holder as not being prejudiced. Now, the Fleetwood case came along in 1990 out of the Austin Court of Appeals. This court denied writ, and they picked up on the Providence decision. They followed that, and in that case they held that in that case there was a property interest that Fleetwood was trying to protect. That was a lease, an inferior lease property interest. He owned the first lien, therefore he had the absolute right to protect his inferior lease interest. He bargained for and contracted that right in order to protect his inferior lien interest. Now,
what rights did Odell lose other than the possibility to pay off the first and second lien?
When this transfer took place?
Well, when? Yes, and he failed to get notice.
Well, the rights he lost, it's according to the bank, as if they were able to cause them the waiver of these notice requirements, then he lost his right altogether to protect his third lien interest, because if they foreclosed, they didn't give him any notice. Therefore, he couldn't exercise his rights to prepay to protect his position in the property.
His sole loss was his potential position in the property.
Well, it wasn't a position, a potential position. He had an absolute property interest in the form of a third lien. Now, when they paid off the first two liens, there was still indebtedness owing to David O'Dell. Consequently, he still had a right to have the security interest that he enjoyed to secure the note and whatever amounts were still owing to him, even when this transfer took place from the first two lien holders. So, yes, it was very significant.
If they could pay that off, all his rights would then be extinguished.
Of course, if they paid off his debt and paid it directly to him, then that would extinguish the debt, and he would be obligated to that.
But I'm trying to
release his lien.
All, and I think you've said this, but I was trying to make it absolutely clear. What he lost in this transaction on the right-hand side of the chart was the opportunity to pay off the total amount of the first and second liens, and therefore...
That's correct. And he lost the opportunity to protect his...
A fee simple interest in the property.
That is correct. Let me conclude that I believe that Fleetwood is identical to this case, that Odell had contracted for and bargained rights of protection of his property interest, which he was deprived and was prejudiced by the bank's transaction.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. In response, when a party, as the bank here, steps into the shoes of another lien holder by paying that lien holder and obtaining the rights of that lien holder, it is correct as a general proposition that he takes the position of the first lien holder as he finds it. But the first lien holder in this case and the second lien holder, Mr. Davis and Mr. Walters, have every right and ability as between themselves and the partnership to modify the terms of that indebtedness, to delete the notice of default provision, to change the payment terms, and to do with it as they please. When my client...
Oh, if they release the payee.
Exactly. The penalty, if we can call it that, for not going to the original maker and obtaining his or her consent, is the loss of the right to seek liability from that person. The interest which Mr. O'Dell was seeking to protect, the interest which Mr. Walters was seeking to protect when he got the 15-day notice of default provision put in that note, was to protect himself from a claim of a deficiency following a foreclosure sale of which he had no notice, no opportunity to cure. It is very important, and if I leave the court with no other thought than this, it would be that we distinguish between the two hats that Mr. O'Dell wore in this transaction. He was the original maker, and in that capacity, his concern and his interest was to ensure that as the party liable, at least initially, that he be protected in the event of a foreclosure sale and have an opportunity to cure. His concern was not that he keep the property, but that he avoid liability. The law is well settled. I would direct the court's attention to Crow versus Willard and the other authorities in our brief, that the present owner of the property and the present owner and holder of the debt can modify that obligation.
But can they do it without notice to the payor who has another interest?
Well, right. And that is our answer is yes, they can. Because in that other interest, with his third lien hat on, he had no right to notice. He had no right to be protected. He could have. He could have gone and gotten an estoppel agreement.
But he may have thought that as payor on these notes, he had it. And he wouldn't lose it unless he knew about it, and if he did, he would go and wire around it some other way.
Well, under established, settled case law, he would be mistaken in that belief.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you respond to, you may have been trying to do it just then, but it escaped me. Mr. Steed mentioned the Provident Savings versus Sims case, 1969, which emphasized that subrogation to first lien rights
steps into the shoes
exists so long as it is without prejudice to the rights of intervening lien holders. His argument that the intervening lien holder has an absolute right to the opportunity to protect his security interests, not just relating to the first two notes, but the security interest from that gave rise to the third transaction.
Your Honor, the cases in the subrogation area have stated, and it is true, that subrogation is not applied so as to prejudice intervening equities. However, the case law makes it clear, and I think the Sanger case, which is cited in our brief, would be one of these cases which make it clear that someone such as Mr. O'Dell, who both before the bank's transaction in the summer of 1986 and after was a third lien holder, is not prejudiced in that sense. Before the bank's transaction in July of 1986, Mr. O'Dell had a third lien behind $189,000. And at the end of July of 1986, when my client had concluded its transaction, Mr. O'Dell had a third lien behind $189,000. His position was the same with respect to his status as lien holder.
Counsel, was not prejudiced. Counsel, the 47 acres from Mr. Hanna, didn't the lien become a first lien then?
Yes, the deed of trust executed by the partnership makes it clear that with respect to the Hanna property, O'Dell was the first one. Because it entered the picture. It was acquired by Mr. O'Dell after the transactions involving Davis and Walters. And that's simply...
So he still has this.
Well, that would certainly be the argument that he does have it. I don't believe that the decision of the trial court made a distinction there, and it is not clear to me that argument was preserved by O'Dell.
But. Should this be remanded then for to sort that out?
That would be one way to deal with it. It may be sufficiently clear from the record that it can be dealt with at this level. To the extent, and I would respond, I guess, a little bit further to a question that Justice Doggett posed about whether or not this can be decided up or down. It can, I think, but there is ultimately a question with equitable subrogation of how do all of these facts and considerations come into play. We've heard a lot of argument about what was intended, what protections people thought they were keeping or giving up. Those are really not developed in this record. If those sorts of factors are important in the decision of this case, then remand would be appropriate because they were not developed in this record.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in both causes today. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise.